Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. I have got my own article today, so I don't really feel it needs a whole lot of commentary because I kind of wrote all the commentary into the article. But as I mentioned, I think last week sometime, this is my journey through the Bcash project or Bitcoin Cash project and what I think the future holds for that coin. And it is titled, How Many Forks Does It Take to Get to the Center of Satoshi's Vision? So without further ado, I'm just going to go ahead and jump in. There is this wonderfully vague idea that I endlessly hear about called Satoshi's Vision. The impossibility of social consensus on the definition of this subjective term makes it a useless term at best and a dangerous one at worst. It is not uncommon to read that Satoshi's vision has certain characteristics one day and then entirely different ones the next. There is neither consistency over time nor consistency between the people who claim to be proponents of Satoshi's vision. I imagine most of the readers of this article are aware, but this concept is most often leveraged by the community behind the incompatible alteration of the Bitcoin consensus chain known as Bitcoin Cash, often abbreviated BCH or Bcash, depending on who's talking. So, how exactly do we define the vision of an unknown individual who's unable to defend or clarify themselves? I've read many differing supposed visions of Satoshi's, and the only constant between them is that it was also the opinion of the person explaining it to me. Satoshi's vision has become little more than a marketing tactic along the lines of all natural and world's best, and it invokes similar feelings as well. When I stumble upon a small town cafe in the middle of nowhere with the world's best pie, for some reason, I'm rarely convinced. So instead, I just want to explore the history and development of Bitcoin Cash. I'll give you my opinion about what I've noticed without arrogantly calling it Satoshi's vision. But because it is my article, I also get to tell you why I think Satoshi would have agreed with me had he stuck around. Wink. So what about Satoshi? Satoshi, before anything else, was clearly an extremely cautious engineer. Security was of the highest concern, made apparent by a number of critical decisions made early on in the Bitcoin protocol, which we will explore throughout this article. But it should be clear that security is paramount regardless of Satoshi's temperament, as anything built on top of the Bitcoin protocol cannot work if there are ambiguous or uncertain outcomes at the core layer. Execution of scripts and contracts must, without question, give identical outputs across all operating systems, code bases, hardware architectures, etc. If not, the network cannot reach consensus. The results of validation in one system may not align with the results of another. This is why some seemingly drastic limitations were purposefully placed on the Bitcoin protocol shortly after its birth by none other than Satoshi himself. Even certain limitations, for example, the block size, that are universally denounced by people claiming to be the true believers of Satoshi's vision. We must also consider the most important decision Satoshi ever made for Bitcoin, the decision to leave. It was his goal to create a truly decentralized protocol that did not depend on any single person or any particular authority's vision in order to survive. Satoshi meant to build a multi-generational protocol without a single point of failure, himself most of all. Quote, Satoshi left because he didn't want its influence to affect the protocol development, creating a single point of failure. The very idea of Satoshi's vision itself is against Satoshi's vision for Bitcoin, end quote. Hasufly. Reliance on the Bitcoin white paper should be treated just the same, especially when accounting for the context under which that document was released. The white paper wasn't a constitution or a legal declaration of how Bitcoin must be perceived forever into the future. Satoshi even said himself that he had to, quote, do it backwards and write the code before detailing what he had built. Many people look at the millions of people, the huge pool of developers, and the overwhelming excitement around the technology today and try to analyze the white paper from that perspective. But the white paper wasn't released on the news to a mainstream audience. It wasn't posted on Facebook and shared hundreds of thousands of times. It was written as a primer to a tiny niche group of cypherpunks who'd spent decades trying to build a money that existed solely in the digital realm. It was a description that was meant to resonate with an email list of people responsible for B-Money, DigiCash, Hashcash, BitGold, and the many Bitcoin precursors. Peer-to-peer digital cash was the only relatable first use for what he had created that made any degree of sense. Quote, sorry to be a wet blanket. Writing a description for this thing for general audiences is bloody hard. There's nothing to relate it to. End quote. Satoshi. When the protocol for the internet was first written, it was rightfully described and built as a protocol for transmitting, routing, and ordering small packets of data. It wasn't sold as a global system of social gatherings, live video streaming, a database for all information on the planet, a system for adaptable, responsive media interaction, encryption and community building, crowdfunding, and a multi-billion application platform for every person on Earth. It wasn't described that way because that would have seemed absolutely ridiculous, when the goal was just to figure out a messaging protocol for connected computers. In the same way we wouldn't constrain every application and feature of the internet to be inserted into the core of the TCP/IP protocol, and we wouldn't go back to the original descriptions of packet switching to find the right vision for the internet, we would be fools to cling desperately to the white paper as the beginning and end of Bitcoin's incredible potential. Why does Bcash exist? The underlying cause of the divorce was indeed a difference between the future direction or vision of the Bitcoin protocol. The majority of the development community was deeply concerned with the trade-off between transaction capacity on the main chain, i.e. the block size, and the censorship resistance or independence of the network. The Bitcoin network is revolutionary only because it is decentralized and thus extremely difficult to shut down. In order for Bitcoin to be able to resist a dedicated and well-funded attacker, say a central bank or nation-state, then the nodes that enforce consensus rules must be agile and low-cost. Like the blockade runners during the Civil War, link, shout out to Carr Campit, you can listen to his article here. For commerce to survive a digital blockade, i.e. state-level adversaries, the system must be fast and lean. The data stream and resource costs to maintain the consensus layer must be able to squeeze through the digital cracks in any firewall or operate over Tor to remain a unified, independent, and globally accessible financial system. However, part of the community was dedicated above all other considerations to merely keeping transaction costs low. Raising the block size, in their estimation, was the simplest way to allow more transactions. It didn't seem to matter that this was barely a drop in the ocean regarding the real scaling problem. You can read about this in my previous article, 7 Misunderstandings of the Bitcoin Scaling Problem. In an effort to keep the communities together, a modification to a proposal called Segregated Witness, or SegWit, was found that allowed a soft fork, or backwards compatible, though smaller and more gradual, increase to the Bitcoin block size. The resentment only seemed to worsen with this development. Despite some claims that SegWit was the ultimate reason that Bcash forked from Bitcoin, roughly 90% of the discussions I saw were all around Bitcoin and its, quote, crippled block size. With the Bitcoin ABC client, the main Bcash implementation, I know it's confusing as hell, the developers removed SegWit from the code and implemented an incompatible change from a 1 megabyte block limit to an 8 megabyte limit, making an entirely separate currency with a shared history. Bitcoin Cash was born. The first fork, breaking Satoshi's difficulty adjustment. On August 1st, 2017, SegWit was finally locked in on the Bitcoin network. And at 12:35 p.m. UTC, block 478,558 was found, which would be the last block shared by both chains. Due to the larger hash rate on the Bitcoin chain, the new block was found on the Bitcoin chain, which was the first to be rejected by all users and services running the Bitcoin ABC client. Note, to add an interesting aside here, you may often hear from Bitcoin Cash proponents that nodes don't matter, that running a full node is both useless and means nothing in the protection of the network. Yet here we see historically that the full nodes were exactly what separated the networks. Every Bitcoin ABC client rejected block 478,559 on the Bitcoin blockchain, despite not yet having a block of their own. Those full nodes remained active, offering a reward in their new currency to any miners who produced blocks following their new rules. It was the full nodes, entirely regardless of hash power, who defined the different rules of the two networks, regardless of whether miners then chose to mine for Bcash or not. But this is a discussion for another day. Removing SegWit, which one developer claimed looked like it had been done, quote, with a hammer, and increasing the block size, weren't the only consensus changes that were made. It was clear that the Bcash network might have unpredictable hash power, especially early on, so it was decided by the handful of developers to alter the difficulty adjustment algorithm, or DAA, that stabilizes the rate of block production. A key element to this new adjustment algorithm that some speculated could be a significant problem was that their adjustment fix was lopsided. It made special rules for lowering the difficulty, making blocks easier to produce, but not for increasing the difficulty, making it harder. The EDA, or Emergency Difficulty Adjustment, instituted a new rule that if the previous six blocks took longer than 12 hours to produce, the next block would have a 20% reduced difficulty. If that next block still did not fix the average, then the following block made another 20% drop. This would continue until a more stable production was restored. It was supposed to only apply to the rare, quote, emergency case of significant hash power loss, hence its name. I can only assume the developers thought a production of less than six blocks over 12 hours would happen maybe once during the uncertain period immediately after the fork, or possibly during some hypothetical future hash power disaster. Certainly this emergency condition wouldn't be triggered on the order of every few days, right? Wrong. Similar to many of their other choices, and in line with what I think is a failure of philosophy of the Bcash project, it was assumed that miners would do what was best for the network. The consequences of an adversary exploiting the new algorithm or merely acting rationally according to the new incentives were either ignored or not taken seriously enough to consider how a malicious miner might abuse this new rule. So when the network finally split, Bcash appeared to be experiencing a hashing emergency roughly once a week. Miners had figured out, basically out the gate, some even speculate this was deliberate, I don't know, that they could manipulate this new consensus rule to their enormous advantage and profit. The simple version. If not mining for just six blocks produces a significant decrease in difficulty that persists for 2016 blocks, why not pull as much mining power as possible from the network, say 95%, to purposefully trigger the adjustment? As long as there was enough mining power to produce at least one block every 12 hours or so, they could just mine Bitcoin while waiting until the Bcash difficulty took a nosedive. Then they'd rush back in with a flood of hash power and gobble up the 2016 blocks that now required mere fractions of the computation as before. Why produce really difficult blocks when you can trick the network into letting you produce really easy ones instead? This resulted in ridiculous swings in block production frequency on the Bcash network. There were periods where blocks would be produced only once every few hours, and even a few occurrences of upwards of 10 hours between consecutive blocks. Then these slow periods would be followed by a flood of blocks being produced at extremely fast rates, at times even pumping out 60 blocks in under a single hour. Here I've just grabbed some screenshots from blockshare.com, highlighting a couple of extremely long gaps between blocks and then blocks that happen multiple times a minute or every minute or two. One might think that the situation would improve with time. In actuality, the periods of extremely low difficulty shortened. In other words, the exploitation of the imbalance by miners was getting more efficient. Rather than balancing itself out, the problem was instead becoming an expectation of the Bcash network and the standard strategy for profit-seeking miners. Screenshot EDA 1 was from September 22nd to September 27th, a 5-day period. Second was on September 30th to October 2nd, a 3-day period. And then third was October 4th to October 5th, barely over 24 hours. Screenshot is from a Reddit conversation. These periods of extraordinary block production came with 12.5 newly issued Bcash with every block, causing a series of sharp inflation hits to the Bcash supply. Still to this day, the Bcash chain is more than 6,000 blocks, or over 6 weeks in normal block time, ahead of the Bitcoin blockchain. We could wonder what they were thinking, considering the huge problems experienced by Namecoin back in 2011, which also shared Bitcoin's mining algorithm. My own speculation, due to the excessive discussion from the Bcash community at the time of how the EDA could trigger a quote chain death spiral on Bitcoin, is that the EDA was implemented not as a way of creating a secure and reliable network for Bcash, but as a mechanism they thought would steal hash power from Bitcoin, Link. The Reddit community, Link, dominant miners and project leaders alike, Link, talked about the different ways they could spam Bitcoin, Link, pull add hash power at key times, Link, and organize pump and dumps, Link, in order to cause maximum harm to the Bitcoin network. How it is exactly that this was closer to Satoshi's vision, I can't say. But if you change a critical stabilizing element of the network with the goal of destroying a competing chain, and it doesn't die, you might just end up having to undo it all. This leads us to Bcash fork number 2, the one implemented to fix the problems caused by the first. The second fork, fixing the first. Now that the project had committed to making fundamental changes to the difficulty algorithm, the task now was to fix the first alteration they made, but still appear as if they were, quote, advancing Satoshi's original difficulty adjustment. Had they reverted back to the original, or copied one of the hundreds of altcoins, the EDA failure would have just been even more glaring. By yet again needlessly inventing an entirely new system, they could attempt to save face. After a few weeks of testing, the team settled on the lead developers, Amaury Sechetz, the same author of the original EDA, D601 algorithm. Founder of the BitPrim project stated, quote, "We expect the new algorithm will mitigate fluctuations in block production, giving Bitcoin Cash users a better user experience and is one step forward aligned with Satoshi's original vision." Another great example of how Satoshi's vision is just whatever they want it to be. Exactly how many different difficulty adjustment algorithms was Satoshi planning to put into Bitcoin? Quote, "The nature of Bitcoin is such that once version 0.1 was released, the core design was set in stone for the rest of its lifetime." End quote. Satoshi. This is where we begin to see the true underlying problem with hard forks as a means of, quote, upgrading the system, one that will prove to get progressively worse as we continue our exploration of Bcash. The brilliant achievement of Bitcoin wasn't that it was a federated PayPal, it was in the ability to separate the monetary policy from political dependence on any single leader or team. It is set in digital stone, if you will. In fact, the more disagreement there is in Bitcoin, the more secure the monetary policy is. Disagreement means consensus on the current shelling point, making Bitcoin the most socially scalable money to ever exist, beautifully elaborated by Nick Szabo in his essay, Money, Blockchains, and Social Scalability. You can read or listen to it here. Link. The breakthrough of Bitcoin was in replacing the trusted and corruptible dependence on political authority with the objective verification of mathematical proofs. Constantly modifying Bcash with consensus-breaking changes is a rejection of this revolutionary element of the Bitcoin system. It's reverting back to votes and political squabbles, where the power of Bitcoin's independence is replaced with a messy social media pseudo-democracy that relies on trusted communication platforms and is vulnerable to cheap Sybil attacks. By rejecting the immutability of the protocol, Bcash has chained its fate to a never-ending fight between which community leaders have the best vision. During their second fork, Tom Zander slammed the Bcash client over the political rather than engineering decisions that led to the adoption of the new DAA, arguing that other algorithms with more testing and review were dismissed, while private reviewers weren't even able to judge the ones selected. Quote, equally curious is that the winner picked was the idea of the developer of the ABC client, the same person that gave us the flawed EDA. Additionally, the BitPrim advisor gave a political reason as the basis of his choice, not a technical reason. The algorithm chosen was previously reviewed and seen as ill-advised. Now there is an updated version that has not actually been reviewed or simulated. I personally have never actually seen the algorithm that was picked. Is the picked one really the best technical solution? I have not seen any evidence at all to support that conclusion. End quote. But with a lead developer announcing a decision, miners agreeing to back the new DAA, and a network oscillating between hyperventilation and going nearly comatose, in November 2017, Bitcoin Cash implemented yet another incompatible change. In what could now be considered foreshadowing, this fork actually resulted in two coins, instead of the intended one. For those who stayed true to Satoshi's true vision, there was now a small group of skilled trolls keeping a heartbeat on the real Bitcoin Cash, now called Bitcoin Classic. For some lulls, I encourage a stroll down Twitter memory lane. Link. Fork number 3. Why not? Before we get into this one, I think it's pertinent to tell a short story about Satoshi and the early implementation of Bitcoin. Originally, Bitcoin had a series of opcodes, otherwise referred to as scripts, that allowed for specialty transaction types and certain modifications. Remember, to verify that all participants are adhering to the same rules, every machine running Bitcoin must execute the scripts on every transaction in the network's history. So if a bug is found that crashes the software with just one transaction, the entire network could be brought down. The risk of even minor bugs in such a system can be catastrophic. So when a bug was discovered and then demonstrated on testnet in the opcode L-shift, enabling an attacker to crash the Bitcoin software, Link, and another in op-return that allowed spending of someone else's coins, Satoshi's response was a testament to just how security conscious he was. Rather than finding a quick fix for the op-L shift and op-return bugs and assume it was solved, he realized there may be no easy way to guarantee the security of an entire group of related opcodes, so he just removed all of them. To err on the side of security above all other considerations, Satoshi disabled 15 opcodes in total, a spring cleaning, Link, of any script that had no clear and present use or couldn't be easily proven to be secure. Image of the list of 15 opcodes disabled by Satoshi. Satoshi knew the key to Bitcoin's success wasn't found by packing in hundreds of arbitrary features or teaching the software to sing songs and juggle flaming swords. The goal, or really the hope, of Bitcoin was to create a monetary system that could survive in challenge to the most powerful political institutions in the world. Governments and central banks' monopoly over money. For Satoshi, this seemed a game of necessity. if a feature of the system wasn't needed, or worse, possibly introduced a weakness, then better to get rid of it entirely. This reasoning is also in line with Satoshi's decision to put in a 1 megabyte block limit in the first place. Realizing that the original block size left the network vulnerable from an adversary simply flooding the network with cheap spam transactions, with little explanation, Satoshi unilaterally implemented the 1 megabyte limit. Again, survival is priority number one. With this in mind, I would hardly call it Satoshi's vision to grab a bunch of the opcodes he disabled to be thrown back into the system with a big public announcement that Bcash would have, quote, better smart contracts than Bitcoin. A move that closely mirrors the hundreds of other arbitrary altcoins desperately trying to market themselves as Bitcoin 2.0. So in the middle of a bear market and declining use, when the average block size of Bcash hovers for months between 50 and 70 kilobytes, and 99.25% of available block space is collecting cobwebs, is it really a necessity to again increase the recently established 8 megabyte limit to 32 megabytes? Well, on May 15th, 2018, that's what happened. 32 megabyte blocks and reinstating a number of disabled opcodes. In addition, a metric referred to as the data carrier size was increased from 80 bytes to 220 bytes, which was even touted as an inexpensive way to store arbitrary data on the blockchain forever, unrelated to the records of ownership. Facepalm. In my opinion, the goal of the May hard fork was mostly to get attention, yet another thing Satoshi wasn't actually a fan of. When Bitcoin was suddenly thrust into the spotlight after WikiLeaks started accepting Bitcoin donations during their banking freeze, just following that is when Satoshi left the project and was never heard from again. He also has never moved any of the coins that were known to belong to him. Satoshi made it clear he was neither in it for the attention nor the money. I would bet both money and attention were key factors in the May 15th hard fork of Bcash. And both were achieved, despite being predictably short-lived. Insert an image highlighting the time that the Bitcoin Cash fork happened and the huge run-up in price and then subsequent decline back into the bear market afterward. Trouble in paradise. I watched Bitcoin Cash very closely and studied every argument I could find for a larger or even infinite block size limit very carefully. I paid particularly close attention during the user-activated soft fork, the Bcash fork, and the failure to launch of SegWit2x. I empathized a lot with the stated goals of the Bcash community, but couldn't get around the itching feeling that the consequences of their priorities and overall philosophy would be disastrous. It is inevitable that all software will have bugs, and Bitcoin is no exception. Link. There are even multiple quirks of the Bitcoin code due to minor mistakes that will simply forever remain part of the system, due to the enormous cost of altering consensus code versus just leaving it and accounting for its existence. Like placing a third signature of zero in the stack of a 2-of-3 multisig for the software to reject before validating the two correct signatures just to prevent the script from freezing. You can learn about this and everything else you wanted to know about Bitcoin in thorough detail by ordering your own copy of Andreas's Mastering Bitcoin through my affiliate link, and you'll support my work while you're at it, A reliance on consensus-breaking changes would undoubtedly increase both the frequency and severity of the bugs that were unavoidable for any software. Bcash has been no stranger to these problems. Just prior to the May 15th hard fork, while Bcash developers were busy trying to add new code and attack vectors, features, to the network, Bitcoin developer Corey Fields discovered a critical bug in Bcash that, if exploited, would have split the network and made safely transacting impossible. Quote, "While looking through Bitcoin ABC's change logs earlier this year, I noticed that one of the most critical pieces of transaction validation had been refactored. The changes jumped out at me immediately because they seemed so unnecessary. Curious about the reasoning behind them, I took a look at the public review the changes had undergone. There was no justification other than, quote, encapsulation. It had only two reviewers, and review only lasted a week before the code was accepted. end quote. Corey Fields. Worse still, two of the very same opcodes that Satoshi removed, L-shift and R-shift, were implemented incorrectly when put back into the client. Link. Everybody gets a hard fork. Quote, the BCH development team feels it's absolutely necessary to have a hard fork every 6 months to keep the protocols upgraded regularly. Hence, a BCH hard fork is scheduled for every 6 months. End quote. Imagine the amount of work and frustration that comes with adapting applications to major changes in something like an operating system. Imagine if every time iOS made an upgrade to their platform, it broke practically every one of the millions of apps in their store. Even with largely consistent operating platforms, vast amounts of work is still needed to address the inevitable conflicts that come with new code. Now imagine how much exponentially larger this problem becomes when making alterations to a base layer protocol where the ownership and value of every financial instrument is dependent on its reliable operation. There's a very important reason that after multiple decades, the internet still uses IPv4. Imagine the amount of capital we would need to expend today in order to suddenly account for an incompatible upgrade to the TCP/IP protocol. Redesigning every router, updating firmware on billions of devices, reprogramming websites, scripts, and on and on. A protocol that thinks this is a smart way to add features is one that horribly stunts any possibility of long-term, sustainable growth. The awesome power of an open protocol is in development that stacks and becomes cumulative over time. Quote, hard fork every 6 months is basically a reset button on that incredible compounding network effect. It puts all the pressure on features at the base layer and wastes development resources on constant maintenance just to keep things running. If Apple had to write every app themselves for iOS, it wouldn't come close to 1% of the utility it's achieved from just having a stable core and fostering a community of hundreds of thousands of developers adding value to their platform. This lesson applies tenfold to a decentralized open source protocol. Quote, Bcash craziness makes me thankful that I removed them from submarineswaps.org when they started spamming their chain. Keeping up with this stuff costs valuable time and money. If you're building for the future, why get involved in supporting chains that aren't sane platforms? End quote. Alex Bosworth. But there's an even bigger problem than software vulnerabilities, the wasting of precious resources, and stunted growth. The rejection of a shelling point in the immutability of the protocol consensus rules was the inevitable dark cloud on the horizon when trying to imagine a bright future for Bcash. I saw that decision as a road toward increasing political infighting, a lack of consistency in direction, dependence on particular leaders, and reliance on hash power to settle disputes. As time goes on, it seems my initial concerns continue to be validated. With another major and contentious hard fork just around the corner, now just days away, and pressure building for a war between the major mining powers on the network, the number of negative developments in the past few months alone paint a pretty bleak picture. 1. The original BCH lead dev, that's right, the guy responsible for the EDA and the current DAA, was kicked from the Slack channel over a disagreement in vision. 2. With the September stress test of their 32 megabyte network capacity, resulting in 16% of the nodes going offline, services and explorers showing contradictory data, and sluggish responses or errors from many BCH services. Still, the largest block was under 22 megabytes, and the median block size was under 4. It confirmed what Bitcoin developers had been saying all along. Ever larger blocks only opens an attack vector on network reliability. It causes a plethora of problems that compound on each other. Its only success was improving its DDoS vulnerability by showcasing the enormous set of problems caused by running the network at a mere 11% of its supposed max capacity for a short period of time. quote, BCH stress test recap. Bottlenecks cause services such as transaction generators to slow and error out, preventing mempool from exceeding 22 megs. Largest block, 21.35 megs. Average block size, 3.6 megs, 11% of max capacity. 16% of Bitcoin ABC nodes dropped off the network. End quote, Jamison Lobb. 3. The same people who demanded larger blocks or they would, quote, fire the developers are now calling foul when the very concern of larger blocks that was endlessly dismissed actually comes to pass when a dominant miner, a buffoon who claims to be Satoshi no less, quote, weaponizes large blocks, dubbing them Satoshi's shotgun in an effort to spam and ultimately kill the competing chain. Quote by Vin Armani. No, there were predictions and preferences. Now that Enchain Global has weaponized big blocks, the argument takes on entirely different meaning. End quote. Quote by Ansel Linder. A spam DDoS attack isn't new, Vin. This was the exact argument against big blocks. End quote. Quote, Giravic. We now know what Satoshi's shotgun is. Giant 30 megabyte plus blocks full of spam designed to crash nodes and slow down competing miners. Luckily, Bitcoin has Satoshi's bulletproof vest, a block size limit. End quote. 4. Supposed community leaders turning on each other with accusations of conspiracy and lies when they fail to agree on the next consensus-breaking changes to be forced onto the network. At Dan Darkpill, quote, according to this barely intelligible article by Calvin Iyer, the Bcash mining cartel summit was a failure because Jihan Wu is a part of a Blockstream conspiracy, end quote. 5. A community that has no recourse but to pick a side or plea for the leaders to agree so they could finally realize the awesome potential of Bcash. Ellie Afram, quote, the reality is if Bitmain, CoinGeek, and Enchain sat at a table to find a unified roadmap that they could all benefit from, it would bring Bcash to astronomical heights. I hope today's meeting can achieve something. End quote. And lastly, with potentially the largest monetary and hashing power supporter of the Bcash network bleeding money, losing their market dominance due to subpar next-gen hardware and a growing list of competitors, making what appears to be a last-ditch attempt at an influx of cash with an IPO, and sitting on a mountain of illiquid Bcash, estimated to be upwards of 8 or even 10% of the total supply. A lingering question is whether Bitmain will stay afloat, and if they fail to do so, while sitting on so much Bcash that selling it would destroy the market, will Jihan choose to save Bcash, or will he save himself and his company? A link to the BitMEX research piece, Unboxing Bitmain's IPO. Quote by Vijay Boyapati. The most important news in the cryptocurrency space today is the gigantic IPO that Bitmain Tech intends to complete this year. But even more astonishing is one of the details buried in their IPO filing. Let's consider the implications. You can follow the link and see his whole thread on the issues of Bitmain. End quote. We could easily spend another few thousand words debating over the specifics of the two opposing clients. Are 32 megabytes, 128 megabytes, or 256 megabyte blocks the true vision for the future of Bcash? What if there's a sudden influx of 30 million users next week? Or does the true future lie in an expansion of dApps running on Bcash forever embedding data into the blockchain? But we won't do this for two reasons. First, others have done the work. Link. If anybody wants to know, Link, the specifics of the disagreement or what they should do to prepare, Link, it's not very hard to find. Who to trust and which chain to follow, on the other hand, is a problem I cannot help you with. And second, because the actual specifics of the disagreement are irrelevant. For instance, I had no idea what the exact contention would be or exactly which fork would be the one that caused the most problems for Bcash, but I did know such a disagreement and disastrous fork was very likely to arrive sooner or later. The fact is, the Bcash community got everything they asked for, They got political leaders, big blocks, smart contracts, powerful miners, and few people running nodes because who needs them anyway? But from my perspective, the current mess is the inevitable consequence of those choices and priorities. Quote, live by the fork, die by the fork. Samson Mao. Bitcoin is here to stay. Maybe there will be a clear winner in the coming chain war, and Bcash will live on to continue its bizarre and messy experiment in social media governance. But I will be holding Bitcoin, where the idea of making breaking alterations to the core layer is now considered a hopeless cause, where consensus rules are not a rolling 6-month agreement. I will hold the first and still only digital currency that stands to be a pillar of immutability, serving its role whether I choose to follow development, stay up to date on mining disagreements, or even know who the community leaders are. The revolution of Bitcoin isn't finding the right blockchain governance. It's in having a shelling point of monetary policy outside of any governance at all. A system that has a social scalability that makes consensus a default, regardless of the endless subjective and socio-political differences between us. A true digital gold that has the potential to last through generations and the life or death of every developer, leader, or company that ever gets involved. If Google were to go up in smoke tomorrow, no one would worry whether the internet would survive. This is the vision that I have for Bitcoin, and I like to think that was Satoshi's vision too. All right, and there we have it. I hope you guys liked that. That was my piece titled, How Many Forks Does It Take to Get to the Center of Satoshi's Vision? And we are now 2 days away from the scheduled time for the Bitcoin hard fork, and there's a bunch of mess still with in-chain and threats back and forth. It's getting pretty crazy. Plenty of reading on it. I collected like 200 links trying to build all the stuff for this article. So I hope you guys enjoyed that one. Don't forget to follow me on Medium and on a Twitter at The Crypto Economy. And of course on Mastodon on the BitcoinHackers.org instance. I am at The Crypto Economy there as well. And if you would like to support the show, you can always check out the website at cryptoeconomy.life. I'll have my donation address up there if you would like to do that. I now have a new donation address actually to my Casa node so that you can help me fund the Lightning channels if you want to do that. And I also put up my Lightning public key, so if you want to send me a Lightning payment, I should be able to receive at least a couple of bucks right now. I'm still playing around with channels and getting funding and all that good stuff. So lots of fun stuff to do there, and I will be talking about all this stuff coming in the future. And I've got the Iterative Capital Bitcoin thesis just around the corner, so stay tuned. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Leave me some feedback. Let me know what you think, and I will catch you all back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.